Hello, and welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from the studios of KALW San Francisco.
Continuing conversations that began at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus.
Today, mental illness and culture.
We're going to consider the way that culture influences and shapes the very idea of mental illness and the way particular mental illnesses express themselves in different times and places.
Let's start with the way that culture shapes our notions of mental illness and our ideas of what a mental illness even is. Take the curious case of Coral. Coral is a mental disorder characterized by a debilitating fear that our genitals are retracting into your body and that when they're fully retracted, you may die.
You don't really find Coral much in Western societies. But in the mid-80s, there was a massive Coral epidemic involving more than 2,000 people in China. And between 1997 and 2003, in several different West African nations, there were big local outbreaks of Coral-like panics.
Now, the reason you don't find Coral in the West, at least not much, is that it seems to be partly based on a set of culturally specific beliefs about sexuality.
Most Coral sufferers are immature, younger men who lack self-confidence and who engage in a lot of autoerotic activity. That's a $10 word for masturbation, which is a $5 word for a number of things I won't say on the radio. These people suffer from extreme guilt and anxiety as a consequence of their autoerotic behavior.
And certain culturally conditioned views about sexuality seem to play an enormous role in causing their guilt and anxiety to express itself in a certain way in this set of Coral-like symptoms.
So does it really make sense to call Coral a mental disease? Coral seems more like a culturally conditioned fear or panic or something. I mean, the panic seems pretty reasonable given the beliefs. So is it really a mental disease? A mental disease is supposed to be something that happens to you because your brain goes haywire in some way or another. Like schizophrenia, for example. A mental disease isn't something that happens because you have certain beliefs.
Well, John, if you look up Coral in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, the book that covers all mental health disorders, you will find Coral listed there. So it's in that manual, but you'll find it in a special place. You'll find it in the back of the book with things called cultural bound syndromes.
But one might worry that that's the American psychiatric profession's way of saying, well, this isn't a good, solid American mental disorder. Those are rooted in the brain. This is some other culture's disorder, and they're just kind of one-off.
Yeah, but John, you know, we don't want to suggest that only certain weird and exotic conditions like Coral and all these other things are shaped and influenced by culture. Take schizophrenia. There is some disagreement about what exactly schizophrenia is, to be sure, but nobody would deny that schizophrenia is something real, something really devastating. It's a real mental disorder, and unlike Coral, it occurs everywhere, not just in this or that culture. But even a disease as transcultural as schizophrenia seems to be culturally and socially conditioned in certain ways.
Well, I mean, that's pretty clear. I mean, the schizophrenic I know best thinks that his whole life is disrupted by the internet, which hypnotizes everyone to plot against him. That's obviously that, at least that belief is culturally and temporally conditioned. You couldn't have it at any time in any place.
Right, right. So there's cultural variation in all sorts of mental disorders. But I think we need to be careful here not to overstate the case for the actual current cultural variation in the way mental illnesses express themselves. Because, I mean, there was more cultural variation in the past, but just like everything else in our rapidly globalizing economy, there are forces that threaten or promise, however you view it, to homogenize cultural differences away, including cultural differences in the way we experience, treat, and understand mental illness.
Well, in a little bit, we're going to be joined by a brilliant local author, Ethan Waters, who's written a book called Crazy Like Us, The Globalization of the American Psyche. He argues that the American psychiatric establishment is, in effect, changing the way mental illness is experienced, treated, and understood around the globe.
Is this rising hegemony, as you could call it, of the American model of mental illness a good thing, a bad thing, or an indifferent thing? Does it represent scientific progress or cultural imperialism? Would it be better to let 1,000 cultural flowers bloom in the treatment, understanding, and experiencing of mental illness?
We'll put these questions and more to our guests in just a bit. But first, our roving philosophical reporter, Rena Palta, looks into a kind of psychiatry that makes cultural context its business. She files this report.
Life is so different here in America.
Mr. Tran is a 54-year-old refugee from Vietnam. He visits his doctor complaining about chronic headaches.
My My muscles are always sore.
I see.
I am weak and I am tired.
Yet his full medical workup shows nothing to indicate the cause of his constant fatigue and pain. So he's referred to a psychiatrist.
Do you have a sense of why this is happening to you? What causes this?
Well, I'm no doctor.
Mr. Tran is a character from a training DVD distributed by the Mental Health Association in California. The case studies help teach psychiatrists and psychologists about the cultural peculiarities of treating Asian Americans.
Underdiagnosis or misdiagnosis can be reduced by being alert to ethnic and cultural specificity in the presenting complaints.
One of the authors of the DVD is Dr. Francis Liu, head of cultural psychiatry at the University of California, Davis. He says that while mental disorders are universal, symptoms present differently.
For example, depression may be experienced largely in somatic or physical terms rather than with sadness or guilt. Complaints of nerves or headaches in Latino and Mediterranean cultures, of weakness or tiredness or imbalance in Chinese and Asian cultures, or being heartbroken among Hopi may express the depressive experience.
By the same token, different cultures offer different explanations for these symptoms.
An example that just shows what happens when this cultural psychiatry perspective is not utilized was described in a very well-known book called The Spirit Catches You and You Fall Down.
The book, written by Anne Fadiman, follows a young Hmong immigrant diagnosed with epilepsy.
And she developed a seizure, and the family viewed this as a shamanic opening. They saw it in a positive sort of way. That had certain meaning to them. However, when the adolescent was brought to the medical center, she was treated by neurologists who took a purely biomedical approach focused on medications.
Despite what the doctors said, the parents didn't give their daughter her medication, and her condition got progressively worse. The prescription wasn't the problem, Lou says. Where the doctors failed was in convincing the parents of the importance of the drug. The challenge for the clinician is often getting the patient to both accept the diagnosis and take the treatment.
There is hope. There's a lot of hope.
In the training DVD, the psychiatrist has used a combination of deference and empathy to coax Mr. Tran's history out of him.
There were very few survivors. I was one of the few.
He learns that Tran saw a lot of bloodshed in the Vietnam War and dreams about the war frequently.
When a person suffers tremendous amounts of stress and trauma, such as yourself, their body and their mind becomes weaker. Your nerves become weaker.
The psychiatrist in the video never uses the phrases post-traumatic stress disorder, major depression, or psychiatric medications, but you can tell he's going in that direction.
There are medicines that we can use that will slowly help you to recuperate, help your nerves to strengthen and your emotions and your body to recover from the traumas that they've suffered.
The psychiatrist sees where Mr. Tran is coming from as a refugee and a Vietnamese American. And he adapts to Mr. Tran's speaking style, vocabulary, and cultural expectations to sell him on a treatment plan that is, in the end, quite Western. For Philosophy Talk, I'm Rena Palta.
I'm John Perry, and with me is Ken Taylor.
And we're joined now by Ethan Waters. He's a frequent contributor to the New York Times Magazine and This American Life, author of Crazy Like Us, The Globalization of the American Psyche. Ethan, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
No, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Ethan, your book is very insightful, but it's also very passionate. What's the source of all that passion?
Oh, that's an interesting question. You know, my interest in this topic goes all the way back to the mid-90s and the recovered memory controversy. I don't know if you remember this, but thousands upon thousands of women going into therapy and coming up with what they believed were repressed memories of being abused, sometimes at the hands of nefarious satanic cults. And not only did they do that, but they also often displayed these very florid symptoms of what was then called multiple personality disorder, now called dissociative identity disorder. And if you needed a lesson in the idea that healers can shape those that come to them to be healed, boy, that recovered memory controversy was a real immersion in that thing. And you do come away from that. There was a very difficult battle to begin to sort of criticize the recovered memory movement. Vicious fight, but also thousands of people really damaged in this process. And if you read a little passion into my current book, I think it does come from that. This sort of a little bit of anger at the mental health world for not understanding the cultural currents that influence it and then go on to influence the patient. I think there's a lack of understanding, and oftentimes there's real damage that's done because of that.
So your perspective is that the psychiatric establishment needs to be, we might say, a little more introspective about the extent to which they shape people's perception of mental illness, and yet I think you think there's something real there. So give us, from a bird's eye perspective, a better answer to the question Ken and I were discussing in our amateur way. I mean, what is the main way in which culture shapes mental illness, and what's the main way in which it's kind of, there's a reality underneath that transcends culture?
Right. I would be the first to say that there is a biological basis to mental illness. There are genetic basis to mental illness. There are mental illnesses that are sparked by life events. But the very next thing that happens, you know, the way you interact with your healer, the way your parents and family begin to look at you, the way your unconscious mind begins to understand the language of distress in its moment in history. How does, you know, oftentimes psychiatrists talk about a general loading of psychopathology in a population. That is, there's some stress out there. There's a government change. There's a famine. There's poverty. But there is no one way for the human creature to express that general loading of psychopathology. And that's when the unconscious mind does something very interesting. It begins to have this conversation with culture about how can I express what this really inchoate thing inside me and have you and everyone around me understand it.
So one of the big problems in American culture, we're told, is depression. It's underdiagnosed. It's hurting the economy. It causes a lot of distress. It seems like a very general disease, and we've got drugs that help with it, you know, Effexor and Prozac. But is our depression the way we experience in America? Do you think that's a cultural phenomenon?
Yes, I do. It is certainly influenced by culture. If you look back even just a generation into the 1970s, the primary symptom of that general loading of psychopathology in the population would have been anxiety, which is very different. Would have been treated by drugs that bring you down, you know, the Valiums and so forth. And then just a generation later, it's now depression, and it's treated by drugs that, by and large, bring you up a little bit. So that is, even something like depression and even something like schizophrenia, I would argue, are influenced by those cultural trends.
But let's distinguish. I take your point, and I'm convinced, but I want to dig just a little bit deeper, because it sounds like maybe there are two things going on, and I'm a synthesizing kind of person, and a synthesis might work like this. Well, something happens to your brain, your cognitive apparatus, your affective apparatus. Something physical traumatic happens, even if it's got cognitive causes, it's going to affect your brain by affecting your chemistry of your brain. And then human beings are inveterate interpreters of their inner feelings, their inner experience, the outer world. And, you know, and culture can enter because whatever happens to the brain affects the mind, affects the interpreting apparatus. So we've got sort of possible physical causes and then psychic interpretation. And that's where it's kind of like a combination. And the reason culture can feed in, it's not because, you know, mental illness is not something that happens to your brain, but it's because in the brain, and trying to make sense of what's happening to it, throws up all kinds of interpretations, and they're going to be culturally conditioned. How's that for kind of a synthesis?
I think that's exactly right. And I think, most of the people I profile in my book are indeed psychiatrists and mental health providers. So this is not an outside thing. The point of the book is that second part of your synthesis, the point where culture comes in and begins to shape the experience and shape the healing experience, the understanding of the people around you, is dramatically understood within the profession. Because I think mental health providers like to think of themselves just as doctors. This is biochemistry. This is just biomedical.
But you could think that real cultural, that the real action isn't in the interpretation, the self-interpretation, the social interpretation. The real action, the real causal action is in the chemistry of the brain, right? And the rest of it is kind of what philosophers call epiphenomenal. It kind of goes along for the ride, but it's not where the real causal work is doing. What do
That's
you think
right.
about
well,
that?
I think if you're a brain researcher or if you're a drug researcher, that perspective is perfectly legitimate. If you are someone who cares for a mentally ill person, the course and outcome of their disease, barring a miracle cure, is the key thing. And I think what you see is culture playing out, even in things like schizophrenia, shaping the experience of the mentally ill person, shaping, you know, even differing remission rates, whether they can perform well in their group. The course and outcome is very much shaped by culture. So it's a critical part if you... I think if you're indeed caring for a mentally ill person.
We're going to have to dig into this more deeply. This is fascinating stuff. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Our topic today is mental illness and culture. Our guest is Ethan Waters, author of Crazy Like Us, The Globalization of the American Psyche.
I'm crazy, crazy for feeling so good.
So what's crazy about feeling lonely or feeling blue? If you grew up listening to Patsy Cline, seems like a perfectly natural reaction.
We're exploring the influence of culture on our conception of mental illness. I'm Ken Taylor.
And I'm John Perry. Our guest is Ethan Waters, author of Crazy Like Us, The Globalization of the American Psyche.
So, Ethan, I think I can guess what you're going to say, but I just want to try something out on you. Two different thoughts about mental illness. One idea is that mental illness are diseases that involve distortions of our thought, emotions, or perceptions. But you could easily think that one person's distorted thought is another person's normal thought. And you can convince yourself, therefore, that mental disease is partly in the eye of the beholder, so partly in the eye of culture. But, on the other hand, you could think, the mind is just a brain, and mental diseases are just sicknesses of the brain. And if that's so, mental disease is no more in the eye of the beholder than heart disease is. What do you think about my two opposing thoughts?
Well, I do think it's critical to know where that line is between the normal and the pathological. And we agree in cultures where that line is. And I think you could see a great example of that in conceptions of depression in Japan circa 20 years ago. They did have an idea of depression, but it was considered an extremely rare condition and an extremely severe condition, like something along the lines of the way we would think of schizophrenia. All other notions of melancholy and sadness in Japan were put in other cultural boxes. But the thing you have to remember is that how we talk about these things and which cultural box we put it in has a cultural momentum. It makes a difference in terms of how you look at yourself in the mirror in the morning, and indeed how everyone around you looks at you, whether you're on one side of that cultural divide. These ideas have momentum. So I think culture, really, one of the key ways it comes into play is drawing that line between the normal and the pathological.
Well, one big shaper of culture these days is corporations. Now, are American corporations that think they have the cure for depression shaping cultures in other worlds?
Well, that's the really remarkable story of what happened in Japan. GlaxoSmithKline took aim at Japan. They saw a culture that really does, in a sense, embrace sadness. And in fact, it thinks of sadness as oftentimes a revered state. And they went in circa 2000, and with the help of many cross-cultural psychiatrists, began to target moving that line in Japan between the normal and the pathological. And indeed, over the last 10 years, the psychiatrists I talked to in Japan suggest that they have managed to do that. Now, many more Japanese who experience certain forms of sadness will now consider themselves mentally ill. And that has a tremendous impact on your life.
And I wonder if that's progress or imperialism or what. And I want to dig into that. I want to invite our callers to help us dig into that question. What exactly is a mental illness? Is one person's distorted cognition or one person's depression another person's normal cognition or effect? Are mental diseases just based in biological abnormalities of the brain without the mediation of culture? Or are mental illnesses inescapably culturally conditioned?
Do you have some deep insights you'd like to share, or do you just have some distorted cognitions you'd like to share? Either way, join the conversation. The number is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. And you can email us at comments@philosophytalk.org.
And we've also got a live blog entry started, an ongoing blog. And if you want to share your comments with the world, go to our blog, theblog.philosophytalk.org. But Ethan, I want to come back to what we were just talking about. So in your book, this is where I read about this. And your book talks about this, or did I read another article? Right. You detail this thing, the attempt of the pharmaceutical company. Which was it?
GlaxoSmithKline.
Yeah, to change the way the psychiatric establishment, and I guess Japanese people themselves, thought about depression. Now, I suppose in their own defense, they would say this is scientific progress. The Japanese psychiatric establishment had mischaracterized depression, had characterized it in a too limited fashion. They had let their culture, you know, blind them to the prevalence of depression within their own society, and all these people went untreated. Yeah. I mean, that must have been something like their take. What do you think of that guy?
Absolutely. I mean, they have this remarkable combination of a profit motive, which is very real, and a moral high ground.
Right.
That's exactly what they would say, and I have no doubt that they also believe that to be true. And indeed, there's even evidence on their side. So they're, you know, the suicide rates, which have always been relatively high in Japan, were on the rise in the 90s during the downturn of their economy there. Introduction of Paxil, other antidepressants coming online, you saw a fall in the suicide rate. So the drug companies can say, look, we're helping the Japanese people because they misinterpreted depression and they needed us to do that. So it's not an argument without some validity. Certainly, I imagine those drugs have saved the lives of some people.
Okay,
in Japan.
But what's the other side? It's not an argument without some validity. I can see the validity. So, but you cite this as, I mean, I get the feel that you think of this as a kind of cultural, not just pure science on the march. It's not just pure science on the march.
It is clearly not pure science on the march. You know, there is that profit motive, and there is all sorts of cultural blowback when you go into a culture and you say, you don't know how to think about the mind. You're not thinking about this correctly. We do this all the time after traumas in Sri Lanka and
right.
Haiti. We go in and say, you need to know our knowledge about PTSD and how to deal with
PTSD
it.
PTSD is?
Post-traumatic stress disorder, your psychological reaction to trauma. We assume we have the answers, and indeed, because we don't ourselves understand how culture has influenced our own ideas, we also don't understand how those other cultures have specific ideas about trauma, about depression, that are very meaningful to them, and indeed, in some cases, are very, very ameliorative of distress.
We'd love to have you join this conversation. We're talking about mental illness and culture. We have a fascinating guest, a fascinating book, The Crazy Like Us, The Globalization of American Psyche. Join the conversation. 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Or as always, you can email us at comments@philosophytalk.org. So look, it sounds like you have an underlying thought that in some sense it's better to let a thousand cultural flowers bloom. I mean, you could think, look, there's a scientifically correct model of mental illness. The American psychiatric establishment has a more nearly correct model of mental illness, and they're serving the world by spreading this model. They're serving the interest of scientific progress. Cultures have to change to reflect science sometimes, and when your culture comes up against the progress of science, well, you know, too bad.
Well, let's take an example of spirit possession notions in Zanzibar.
Yeah.
I'm not a believer in spirit possession notions. I don't think it's the accurate representation of what's going on in the mind of a schizophrenic. However, when you study spirit possession narratives in some cultures, you can put aside the question of whether it's true or not and say, how does it affect this person's sense of belonging in the group? Does it keep that person, the ill person, within the group, or does it exclude them from the group? And I think those narratives that keep the ill person within the group actually oftentimes have a tremendously positive effect on the life of the ill individual. So you're putting aside truth, false, science, not science, and saying, what are the other ways this plays out?
So one could say, look, let's assume that there is an underlying brain-based disorder involved with, say, schizophrenia. And let's take it for granted that American science is making progress, although slow, on understanding that. And let's assume that within the American context, if you can get a schizophrenic to stay on medication, that makes their life better. Still, the question is that medication effective because it's affecting the basic situation, or because it's doing something that in the particular culture changes things that makes them better that might not be transported or might not even be as good as some other device that already exists in some other culture like the one in Zanzibar, even if they don't have the understanding of the underlying cause, they may have a solution that in their culture works better than our medication.
Well, I think that's right, and I think it's that observation is backed up by a really remarkable World Health Organization study that went over two decades, multi-site study about outcomes with schizophrenia, and they found that indeed, schizophrenics in the developing world did better, not just a little better, a lot better than schizophrenics in the first world with all our resources and attention and knowledge about the brain. So there does appear to be something going on in other cultures that has a remarkable effect on even something like schizophrenia.
Yeah, that's an amazing statistic. I was reading about that last week when I was preparing for the show. It amazed me. But you know, we've got lots of callers in this line. We'd love to have you join this conversation. 415-841-4134. Give us your insights. And Ron in San Jose is on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Ron.
Hi.
What's your comment or question?
Thanks for taking my call. We have a tendency to blame corporations and drug companies in particular, but aren't they sort of ultimately actually trying to help people?
Well, that's a challenge to you, Ethan. What do you think? Thanks for the question, Ron.
Well, I think so. I think, you know, I'm not an opponent of antidepressants. I do think, though, and there's been some remarkable revelations just recently about the early science of Paxil in particular and antidepressants in general, and they do show that there is indeed a problematic way the science has been created. There's, for instance, the connection between the drug companies and the researchers who put their names on these papers. But I still think that, you know, I'm not an opponent of psychiatric drugs. Indeed, I'm married to a psychiatrist that uses these things. Most responsible people in the field know that there's value in these drugs. But we do have to, I think, watch out for the drug companies and the profit motive and make sure there are checks on whether they get to create the science that they then go forward.
I want to come to a dinner party at your house and get you and your wife arguing about this stuff. But we got more callers on the line. The number, I remind you, is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. And Randall in San Francisco is on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Randall.
Thank you. Thank you for taking my call. My question has to do with bipolar disorder and what medical doctors refer to as hyper-religiosity. I've had a number of what have been characterized as manic episodes by doctors, but in a religious context, might be viewed as more of a religious experience, a communion with God, a insight into the human condition, and whatnot. And so my question has to do with the cultural context of the United States, which, you know, is particularly secular and views religion as this, you know, kind of crazy thing, and the way in which that colors the view of my experiences. In other cultures, it might be viewed as, you know, some sort of ecstatic experience to be honored.
Thanks, Randall. Fascinating call. Fascinating question.
Well, I think you're fundamentally right. I myself am not a believer, but I do have a tremendous admiration. After studying, for instance, the spirit possession notions in Zanzibar, and I think I have a better understanding. And I think there's just one sort of dividing line between these narratives that I think is worth considering. It's which beliefs about a mental illness keep the ill individual within the group. And in Zanzibar, a spirit possession belief is very common. Everyone, you know, it makes you one of us. And in our culture, I think, as you suggested, that same spirit possession notion might be the thing that excludes you from the group.
I think this is something profound, and I think it has a lot to do with a lot of, look, Americans, Westerners have a certain conception of the self in relation to others, right? We believe in autonomy, self-governance, self-flourishing, independence, and if you can't do that, you're not being a fully intact self. Other cultures have a more inclusive conception of the self, right? Asian cultures have a more, the self as connected to society. So you don't have to sort of function on your own to be a fully functioning member of society. So that in America, anything that makes you dependent on others too much is already bad, is already bad. And mental illnesses that make you dependent on others too much, it's a deeply problematic. But other things that don't interfere with, in other cultures where that mental illness may not interfere with your network of relations, you can thrive more. What do you think about that,
though? I think that's exactly right. I mean, in Sri Lanka, after the tsunami, for instance, the Sri Lankans were more likely to explain their distress in terms of their inability to fulfill their social role in the group or the damage done to their social group. Whereas in America, you experience trauma, you're likely to think of that as something bad that's happened in your brain, and I need to take time away from my social group in order to heal from that. But indeed, for a Sri Lankan, the very expression of mental health would be my participation with the group, my ability to fulfill my role. So it's a fundamentally different connection, you know, different dichotomy between the egocentric self and the sociocentric self.
Can this cultural dichotomy occur within a given society, like our society? I mean, it seems to me that we have kind of two paradigms of elementary school children, the studious little girl that does her homework and is in quiet in class and listens to the teacher, and the rambunctious little boy. And the rambunctious little boy has become kind of unacceptable, and we give them drugs so that they'll be more like the studious little girl. And then on the other hand, once they grow up, we want them to be entrepreneurs and self-directed and so forth. But is the whole drugification of little boys a part of the same phenomenon that's involved in the globalization?
I think so. I mean, every chapter in this book comes back to America in the end and makes the case, indeed, that the way these cultural currents are changing other cultures is reflective of basically what's happened here in America 10 years ago. So we go through the same cultural evolutions of ideas, the same cultural evolutions of how the brain works, how to medicate it. And then once it becomes common knowledge or common belief in our culture, we think of it as this must be true. Then we take the show on the road.
You know, it's a strange thing, because you might think the medicalization of these illnesses would be an instrument of liberalization. It's not something wrong with you. It's something, your brain. We don't ostracize people because they have heart disease. But I've read some stuff that suggests the medicalization actually makes it worse for people, because you think, you're really broken. You're really screwed up. You don't belong with the rest of us.
That's exactly right. It's an unfortunate aspect of convincing the world to think biologically and medically about these illnesses. Those who believe that, who come to believe in that idea, tend also to be the ones that want more social distance from the mentally ill, to think of them as more permanently broken, more violent, more unpredictable. And it does not, it's not a silver bullet against stigma, unfortunately.
A quick question that may require a long answer, but we can continue after the break. There's a traditional distinction between neurosis and psychosis. Does that play a role in what's really cultural and what's not?
We're going to hold that for after the break, okay? You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're discussing mental illness and culture. Our guest is Ethan Waters, author of Crazy Like Us, The Globalization of the American Psyche.
Is the globalization of the American psyche a good thing, a bad thing, an indifferent thing? Does it represent scientific progress or an illegitimate form of cultural imperialism? Should we let 1,000 cultural flowers bloom in the realm of craziness? Or should we all strive to arrive at one true picture of how the mind does and should work?
Scientific progress or cultural imperialism? Plus more calls and emails when Philosophy Talk continues.
And you know, two heads are better than one.
Yeah, if two heads are really better than one, what's so bad about having a split personality? What can psychiatry learn about the relationship between mental illness and culture, and what can it tell us? I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. We're discussing mental illness and culture. Our guest is Ethan Waters, author of Crazy Like Us, The Globalization of the American Psyche.
Ethan, first let's follow up on that question I asked at the end, neurosis and psychosis. That's what I was taught, you know, years ago. That was an important distinction. And neuroses were kind of more cultural, cognitive, not maybe so deeply grounded in disorders of the brain. Psychoses were like schizophrenia, and they're different. Is that still a valid distinction, and does it apply to these problems you're considering?
I think it is a valid distinction. I think you could see in terms of depression and post-traumatic stress disorder, things like anxiety, culture playing more of a role in shaping that. And certainly you can see with some psychotic illnesses you can say it's more biochemistry, and you can look for the cause there. That said, however, you don't want to divorce culture from things like psychosis. The remarkable thing, really, and the most surprising thing I found in researching the book is how much culture impacts even those illnesses in terms of how they play out.
This is Philosophy Talk. We'd love to have you join this conversation. 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Or you can email us at comments@philosophytalk.org. Look, Ethan, I want to play this game that we often play when we have a controversial. It's clear you don't endorse the exporting of the American psyche the globalization of the American psyche, as you call it. So we're going to make you king of the entire world for a day or a week, however long it takes. And we're going to give you plenary powers to reorganize the way mental illness is understood, explained, and treated around the world. What do you do?
Well, that's a great question. I mean, I often get out from under that question or questions like it by saying, you know, you can't stop globalization, but you've put me in the position to say, well, now you can.
Yes.
If you wanted to,
if you wanted to.
And I think that's an excellent question. And my answer is I wouldn't. I wouldn't stop the sharing of ideas across culture. I wouldn't try to redraw cultural boundaries such that they're uninfluenced by each other. I do think the West has knowledge and drugs to share with the rest of the world, and I would not want to stop that knowledge. So here's what I would want. I would want us to look at other cultures and understand the value of the way they approach these experiences and human nature, and not only human mental health, mental illness, but mental health as well. Understand more about their sociocentric mind and how that might be very helpful to the human consciousness. So basically, before we go in and erase their narratives and replace them with our own beliefs, in our science or what have you, that we understand the value of it, and there is some shared dialogue.
So
there's information going back and forth.
You're kind of advocating on the part of the American, I mean, to implement the American Psychiatric Association and the American drug industry and all these on the American Academy, I assume, too, would have to have a kind of epistemic humility about, because they think that they've got it. They think, I mean, look, and you look at the DSM, I mean, it's prior to the DSM-3, I think it was, I'm no expert on this, but there was all this psychoanalytic stuff that just, by DSM-3, was just rejected and thrown out of that thing. And DSM-4 is, and I think DSM-3 seemed not to really have a coherent model of the mind. DSM-4 is more like, I don't know what DSM-5 is going to be like, but the Americans, like, that thing changed radically. And I suppose the people who wrote it in any given day were fully confident of their models, but it suggests to me that we are so at sea at understanding the mind in a deep way that we need to have a lot more epistemic humility.
I think humility is key, and you know, every generation of psychiatrists and mental health professionals looks back at the last one and says, oh, look how influenced they were by culture. Look at hysteria, mm-hmm. look at recovered memory controversy, but now we've really cleared our minds and we're just looking at it scientifically. And indeed, that's just never going to be the case with mental illness. Culture will always play out.
Well, let me try another little thought experiment. Suppose marijuana had just been invented by an American drug company, and they found out that it was good for combating certain medical problems. Wouldn't the situation be a lot different? Rather than this 20, 40-year struggle to get medical marijuana recognized, wouldn't we just have a tremendous amount of money and advertising thrown into the acceptance of it? And the general point is that people in the non-drug folk therapy culture complain that if something's patented and owned by a big corporation, it gets tremendous play, whereas lots of other good remedies, because they don't lend themselves to the profit motive, just get kind of lost. And it seems like you're pointing to the same phenomenon.
That's right. And if you look at the creation of the science surrounding these drugs, you also find that drug companies have remarkable resources to put into the creation of the scientific papers that then go on to influence the decisions like the FDA and other cultures. And I think if marijuana was created by a drug company today, you'd probably have the creation of a science around it that showed it to be very efficacious. And indeed, and then there's the marketing and all the information down the line that very much would shape our cultural consciousness about it.
Well, just to say the science would be fraudulent, but just that it would exist and otherwise it might not.
Yeah, but there are edges of that fraudulent. I mean, they're skewed might be the other way to put it. Not fraudulent, but
Not totally objective.
So,
but I, okay, so this is a very speculative question. I'm a big believer in the scientific study of mind and cognition, and I think one of the things that the study of mind doesn't really have is a completely worked out story of the broken mind. I think that's right, and I think that shows up in all kinds of things. But I guess I'm an optimistic guy that believes that eventually we will have a complete, well-worked-out scientific theory of mind, and our treatments will follow from that. And then all this cultural stuff, maybe we can derive as a consequence. You know, if you treat it the cognitive level this way rather than that way, you're going to get some good effects. But I guess I still believe that at the fundamental level, it's about the chemistry of the brain, and once we fully understand that, and if we can learn to directly intervene in the chemistry of the brain, you know, that will be liberating and not restricting.
Right.
I guess I believe that at some level.
You're such an optimist.
I am.
Well, here's the tricky part.
I'm a scientific optimist, too. So,
but here's the tricky part with that, which is that the biomedical idea about the brain exists in two fundamentally distinct ways. One, it's the science behind it, the very real science, the brain research, the papers, the statistics, the measurements. But then the biomedical idea about the brain is also a cultural story that we share about ourselves and about how the mind works. And that goes to influence the people that care for the mentally ill, the people mentally ill themselves. So you have to see it both as a cultural narrative and as a real thing, and then we never get away from the cultural idea.
I agree about that, but culture, in some sense, I mean, it doesn't float free of our real knowledge of the physical world. And if it does float free of our real knowledge, I mean, one of the things we talked about, good cultures that help schizophrenics survive, and all, but you know, lots of cultural artifacts have been discarded for the better. Right, I mean, old Victorian ways, you know, hysteria and all this stuff. Lots of that stuff has been thrown in the junk heap, and some of it's been thrown in the junk heap for the better, don't you think?
Oh, absolutely. And spirit possession notions in other cultures are often the cause for tremendous cruelty towards the mentally ill person. So it's not that other cultures have it right. This is not, you know, the mistake of a young anthropologist is always to be, oh, that other culture is so pure and has it right. And that's not the case I'm making. I'm making the case that sometimes even spirit possession notions can play out in unexpected ways, and we need to understand them before we erase them.
Well, on that note, I'm going to thank you for joining us. This has been a really fascinating conversation, and I highly recommend to everybody that they read your book.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Our guest has been Ethan Waters, frequent contributor to the New York Times Magazine and This American Life, another fine radio program, author of Crazy Like Us, The Globalization of the American Psyche. So, John, what thoughts do you have here now today?
Oh, mostly I'm worried about my genitals receding into my body.
I mean, now you're going to go suffer from coral.
Yeah, how about you?
You're not the right profile for
well,
that.
Well, I just opened my mind to mental illnesses from other cultures. Why can't I have those as well as the ones from my own
well,
culture?
Well, my final thought is this is a really, really fascinating topic. I'm going to think about it some more. I'm going to finish reading Ethan Waters' fine book. I've read about half of it, but it's a fascinating read. Maybe I'll blog some more. I started a blog, and you can read that blog. This conversation has already started on the blog, theblog.philosophytalk.org, where our motto is cogito ergo blogo, I think, therefore I blog. And also, you can download podcasts of our program from our website as well. And now, we are joined by KALW Development Director Diane Keel, along with our very own Merle Kessler, a.k.a. Ian Scholes, the 60-Second Philosopher's. Welcome, guys. What's on your mind now?
It's wonderful to be back with you, which we do every year at this time. It's kind of fun to be in the studio with the two of you. And we want to remind everybody, because we have had some wonderful calls so far this hour, we want to remember them, clicks and calls. That's what we need, clicks and calls. And when you make those clicks or you make those calls, you're saying, KALW, we really appreciate what you do. 1-800-525-9917. That's the number to call.
I think clicks must refer to the internet, right?
That'd be
clicks, yes, clicks do.
Yeah. You click on that, go to the Donate Now button, click on that, and then donate. Now.
And by doing that, you will prove something to this to the management here at this station, including Diane Keogh. You will prove that you support quality programming, and in particular, you will prove that you support quality programming like Philosophy Talk, and you'll get to keep listening to us.
There
and
is
if you
nothing
don't do
like,
that.
There's nothing like Philosophy Talk. There is absolutely nothing like it on the air anywhere, and we are so proud to have it here. We appreciate what you two do every week. It's stimulating. It's exciting. exciting. It's interesting. Sometimes it's funny, but it is always entertaining one way or another.
And even more often, it tries to be funny.
Yeah, well, no.
If you're listening to Philosophy Talk in the Bay Area, or you're listening to Philosophy Talk on the internet, well, you ought to donate some money to KALW. If you're a student and can afford $5 or $10, that's great. If you're an entrepreneur and you're rolling in dough and can give us $1 billion, that would be great. And anything in between.
And I know people don't give to public radio and the KALW just because they want the goodies. But here's a thing. If you give us money, we'll give you something in return. We'll give you some goodies in return, right?
What, yes, for an $80 donation, you will get Ethan Waters' book, which is an excellent book. You've been talking about this entire hour. For $75, you get me, a CD of me.
No, you don't get him, you just get his CD.
Yeah. This is a CD, yeah. Well,
this is an epistemic, this is a metaphysical distinction. Between...
For $50, you can have me.
Suppose somebody wants to give $75 but get Ethan Waters' book. Can they do that?
No.
You got to give that 80. But
if they get his book at $80 and they're a new member, they'll get both the book and the new member pack. The new member pack has a refrigerator magnet, but really old-fashioned radio. It has a bumper sticker and one of those static window stickers that you clearly can't see, but you can only see just a little bit. Really kind of neat. So that's the new package for the new members. And if you go at the $80 level, you can get a new member pack, if you are a new member, and the book, which is very readable. As I said, it's a book that you and I can read and understand rather than just say, throw your hands up and say, oh, this is beyond me.
And you can put the sticker on the book if you want.
Yeah, you could.
Yeah. So then you said that there's nothing like Philosophy Talk on the radio. And I think that's right. But that proves something else. You know, we're on about 60 or so stations now, so we're spreading a little bit across country. But the way we got started is because KALW was willing and eager to take a risk on something that hadn't been done on the radio. Philosophy on the radio. Lots of people said, philosophy on the radio. But you know what KALW said when we approached him? Philosophy on the radio. What an idea. Let's give it a try. That means not only are we a one-of-a-kind station, but KALW is a one-of-a-kind station. And if you want things not to be, we were talking about the homogenization of global culture through the spread of American capitalism and all that. If you don't want homogenized radio through the flattening down of difference, you've got to support this unique station, this one-of-a-kind station that is willing and eager to put on one-of-a-kind programming like this and all other sorts of things that KALW puts on.
And local programming. It's a big emphasis on the Bay Area.
Yeah, we are very proud of our local programming, and we know that you are too, because particularly our news that has just started has received such a wonderful broad audience already, because they go deeper into the questions. They don't just have talking heads. They go into the stories around your neighborhoods, and that's what we are. We are your local public radio.
So if you want to, they say, put your money where your mouth is. We know you're out there listening. We know you're not eating the radio, but you know what you need to do? You need to put your money where your ears are. Put your money into KALW. And how can they do that?
Well, you just got to call 1-800-555-9917. Or
no, not 555.
525.
Sorry.
No problem.
My number's dyslexic, sorry. Or you can go to KALW.org and click on the Donate Now button.
And if you're old enough, like I am, to remember when milk came non-homogenized and the the cream would rise to the top, yes, and you'd pour off the cream. And now that, when you do, that's KALW, the cream on the top of non-homogenized radio.
Yeah, there you go.
1-800-525-9917. Make that call. Make the click at KALW.org and click on that Donate Now button. You go down and look at the gifts. We have lots of gifts, a way to say thank you to you. But our best way of saying thank you to you is to continue bringing you this wonderful programming and the rest of the interesting programming that we bring. We are not a very homogenized station.
No,
we are pasteurized, though.
Well, they're not going to put us out to pasture, I hope, unless fail to get off your dock and do your part.
Exactly.
You know, when I got into this radio gig, I learned a fact about public radio.
What was that?
I thought public radio people were public-spirited people who gave until it hurt. And it's true, but you know, it's only 1 in 9 on average that listen. So there are a lot of freeloaders out there. And I don't want you to be freeloaders, San Francisco, Bay Area. Don't be freeloaders. Get off your duff and do your part, you know? Don't ask Smith to help you because he'll turn the other. Get off your duff, do your part. Show up. Put your money where your ears are.
Or you can stay on your duff, but just pick up the
phone.
It
doesn't matter. Yeah. While you're sitting down, you can make a phone call. Any of those things are possible. You know, when we started this, we were going for 4,000 clicks or calls. That's internet and telephone. And we think that it's a lot, but we also know that we have enough listeners out there who are or are not members who can make that 4,000 come true. You can be one of those people. You are out there and you are waiting to let us know that you love us, you listen to us. Just pick up the phone. You don't have to give us $1,000. There are folks who can, and we'd love to have it. But if you can't, the $25 for seniors and students, $50 basic membership, 1-800-525-9917. Talk to the phone room. They'll look glad to tell you about it.
Yeah, 1-800-525-9917. Get off your duff. Do your part.
Do your part. 1-800-525-9917 right now or at kalw.org. Click or call. Show your appreciation for Philosophy Talk and the rest of KALW's programming.
Thank you.